Good afternoon. It is 12:02 on a Friday. Not a bad day at all. I'm Eric Scott, and of course, back from vacation, our regular Friday guest, State Senator Jeb Bradley. Mr. Bradley, thank you again for making the time. I really do appreciate it, and welcome home.
I'm glad to be home, and thank you very much. Good to talk to you, Eric.
How was your vacation?
You know, I had a great time. I hadn't seen my kids in 2 years because of the pandemic.
Wow.
Three sons live in Colorado, and my daughter lives in the state of Washington. So a long ways away. We hadn't wanted to get on a plane for a long time. And so we decided to drive to Colorado, and my daughter came for a few days, and so we did a little bit of hiking, and then Karen and I went to southwestern Colorado, where I used to, spend a little bit of time, and we hiked there, too. And then all good things come to an end, but we took quite a while to drive home and went through the Great Lakes, which I'd never really visited any of them, which is kind of sad because they're gorgeous. And we spent time on Superior and Michigan in particular, but a little bit of opportunity. So I went swimming in all five of the Great Lakes at one point or another, either on the drive out or the drive back, and I went swimming in the Mississippi River. So, those are pretty cool things. And the last that, just sort of a personal thing, I've been in 49 states. Prior to driving out to Colorado, North Dakota was the only state in the nation I hadn't been in at some point or another. And driving on the way back, we actually stopped at Mount Rushmore, which was gorgeous, and we saw the ceremony there. Then the next day, we drove to Pierre, South Dakota, and spent the night near there, and then the next morning got up and drove through the southeastern corner of North Dakota. So I have now officially been in all 50 states.
Well, congratulations.
So, anyway,
that's
we had
pretty
fun.
Cool. Yeah, it sounds it. It sounds like a lot of fun. All right, let's get to some questions today, if you don't mind. I have a whole bunch of questions on probably a couple of dozen different subjects.
Okay.
First one is, why is the state of New Hampshire in the alcohol business?
It's been like that for a long time. We receive somewhere in the range of $175-ish million for the general fund for, running the State Liquor Commission. So it's a way, I think, of providing affordable spirits and wines to New Hampshire people, but also visitors, and it provides needed revenue to the state of New Hampshire.
Right, but couldn't we theoretically sell concessions to sell alcohol? Then we wouldn't have bureaucracy.
We definitely could privatize it and sell the whole thing lock, stock, and barrel, or just retain the wholesale part of it, I suppose. But, when you're trying to piece together a budget, $175-ish million that goes straight into the general fund of profits, which is what it is a pretty good way to, raise revenue without taxing people. I haven't heard many complaints about the state liquor stores. Obviously, you can get beer and wine in grocery stores, package stores, etc. If you are purchasing spirits, you have to go to a state liquor store, but people don't complain about it very much, and I think most people enjoy the fact that the pricing is more affordable because it's, run by the State Liquor Commission.
Well, I think the only other state that does it like that is Pennsylvania.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's something that has gone on for a long time. There has been some discussion about, you know, selling it, and it would be a very, very valuable commodity, you know, for a, you know, independent, privately owned entity to purchase, you know, all of the assets of the State Liquor Commission and then obviously run the, you know, the liquor stores. But I'm not sure that it's, you know, given the benefit in terms of pricing to people and the fact that it actually draws people to New Hampshire, which is good not only for liquor revenue, but, you know, other things that people would buy when they come here. And it, you know, as I keep saying, it brings in a lot of revenue.
It's easy for me to say because I don't drink. But I'm curious about something. When you buy a drink, in a bar or whatever, is that subject to tax?
So it's subject to the rooms and meals tax. And the owners of the bar would buy their spirits through the, you know, State Liquor Commission, and they pay, I believe it's an 8% surcharge, but they get it at a wholesale rate. So, again, I think it's pretty competitive for, you know, for restaurants to be able to purchase wine and right. Spirits.
Isn't that a double tax, though, if you're taxing individual drinks but not bottles?
Well, it's a different tax. It's a surcharge for the restaurant owner when they go and purchase. The wholesale purchase of wine and spirits, and as I said, I believe it's an 8% surcharge, okay? So that's the owner of the facility pays that, but they're buying, you know, the spirits and the wine at wholesale. And then if I or you go, you know, to a restaurant and we have a meal with a drink, you're paying, you know, the rooms and meals tax. It's no different than, you know, than beer, which there's a separate tax on beer by the barrel, the way the beer tax works. And that's paid by the brewer. But then if you buy a beer in, you know, a restaurant when you're eating a meal, you would also pay the rooms and meals tax on that. So it's, you know, at different parts of the consumption, so to speak, different entities. It's the restaurant owner that pays the surcharge or the beer tax. It's the patron that pays the rooms and meals tax.
Okay. Thank you for that
again,
answer.
So when we have this discussion about taxation in New Hampshire, you know, as part of the overall picture of New Hampshire not having a sales tax, not having an income tax, not having a capital gains tax, and so how have we been successful in running, you know, state government? I mean, you have to have some revenues. You have to efficiently manage things. I think we've done that in New Hampshire over the years because, you know, we don't have these other taxes which tend to create bureaucracies and drive up the cost of government in other states. But we, by having, you know, the tax structure that we have, yes, alcohol gets taxed and or the profits of alcohol go into the general fund, but that, you know, alleviates the need for another source of revenue. And I think, you know, it's because of that that we, you know, we're a pretty well-run state. We provide services to people that need services with less bureaucracy, I think, than a lot of other states. And we, you know, have a relatively low tax burden when you compare our tax burden with, you know, other states and the rest of the country. And certainly not having a sales tax, an income tax, or a capital gains tax is a real advantage. And, you know, people would say, well, you know, what about property taxes? I mean, again, those are locally driven for education, county, and town. But over the past couple of budgets, we've put a lot of new money, state funds, because we've been running large surpluses into education funding. It's almost $250 million over the last two budgets of new education dollars. And then we passed in the budget Senate Bill 99, which dedicates 30% of the rooms and meals tax revenue in a dedicated fund directly to cities and towns for property tax relief. And that, that had never been fully funded, and it was very easy to divert that rooms and meals tax money. Now, by virtue of the fact that it's going into a dedicated fund, it, will be the first priority when that money comes in, that 30% of it goes to cities and towns. So I think that, the growing economy that we've enjoyed in New Hampshire has enhanced our ability to lower property taxes, too, both on the education side of the ledger and the town side of the ledger. And lastly, we use surpluses to help county governments, too, in the last budget. So I think I know I've sort of gone off track about the question on the liquor commission, but it's all part of a larger picture of how we run state government and how we keep taxes relatively low in New Hampshire compared to other states. Right.
Okay, thank you for that answer, Senator. As you well know, we talked about it on Brody Deshaies' show on Wednesday, on All Things Politics here on WASR. What was your reaction when you found out that Representative Dr. Marsh joining the Democrat Party?
Yeah, well, I haven't had a chance to talk to Bill, and I'd like to, have a chance to talk to Bill. I know that, there was some disagreements between, Representative Marsh and the House leadership, and it's unfortunate that, it came to this. I mean, Bill's a really good guy. I don't think he's changed his views on, the big issues of the day. It's just an unfortunate situation. So let me leave it at that.
Okay. Is that common? Have you seen this kind of party switching before?
It happens, but it's rare. It happens.
Will there be political repercussions for him?
Not being in the House, it's hard for me to, judge it from, where I sit. I mean, look, on healthcare issues, I'm still going to work with Bill. I chair the Health and Human Services Committee in the Senate. He's very knowledgeable about, healthcare issues as a, doctor. Obviously, now he's retired, and he does his homework, and so I tend to try to work with everybody and look less at party affiliation and more at the issue. And so I'm going to continue to do that.
He's a nice guy. He really is.
He's a great guy. I mean, I've told many people this story. When my oldest son, Jan, was probably 7 or 8 years old, he was over at a friend's house, and they were playing with a child's chemistry set, and somehow Jan managed to get sodium hydroxide, which is the active ingredient of lye, which is like the active ingredient of Drano, into his eye.
Ooh.
Thankfully, the parents at the kid's house he was staying at washed his eye out thoroughly immediately and drove right to the emergency room. And Dr. Marsh and his partner, who's at Memorial Hospital now, spent 10 hours getting his pH level in his eye back to normal. But, it was the first couple hours was touch and go. And I always have credited Dr. Marsh with saving, you know, Jan's eyesight. And, you know, that's not the kind of thing you ever forget. It's a lot larger than, you know, party affiliation in my mind.
Sure. So, as a parent, I can understand that.
Bill will always be a friend.
All right. Why do you think a third party has such trouble getting off the ground?
You know, it's just our system of two parties and all the institutional aspects of running campaigns and fundraising and how our primary structure works. It just there's too many roadblocks for successful third party candidacies. It's, you know, there are very few people like, you know, Ross Perot actually had a huge influence over the 1992 election. He was sort of the last third party candidate that, you know, did well. And it takes somebody that can self-fund, has huge name recognition, you know, to be able to, you know, do that. And it's just, there are a lot of roadblocks in the system of government that we have for third parties.
What kind of roadblocks do you mean?
Well, you have to win primaries to get on the ballot.
Right.
So that's either Republican or Democratic. Libertarians sometimes have ballot status, but, you know, even when they really work hard, they generally don't get more than 5 or 6% of a vote. You know, and it's just the way people look at, you know, the political life in the United States. It's one of either party, and obviously they're different. You know, everybody in the Republican Party or the Democratic Party does not always toe the same line. There are different points of view within the membership of each party. Not everybody, you know, I don't agree with every Republican and I don't disagree with every Democrat. So all the time on all the issues. But it just, in terms of being able to run successful campaigns, just the way our system works, you know, fundraising, primaries, advertising, messaging. To be a third-party candidate, you have to have, you know, a huge amount of personal resources to run a big, you know, campaign. Name recognition is vitally important. You know, those are things. Now, I think in Maine, Senator Collins, and who's the other senator? And Bernie Sanders, obviously, is another example. And so is Joe Lieberman, as I recall, for a while, that, you know, they branded themselves, I think Senator Sanders does in particular, as an independent. But, of course, they caucus with a Democrat.
Right.
So, you know, could any of them run as a third-party independent and be successful? Maybe Sanders could. But, you know, it's just the roadblocks are the perception that voters would have of you. And when you get outside of the, you know, party process, it just becomes harder for all of those things, messaging, fundraising, infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, plus I think that Mr. Sanders would have trouble because he attracts only a certain percentage of the Democratic Party, being a little bit more left of center than the average bear. So I think that he would have trouble because he just couldn't get the numbers.
I think that Bernie Sanders would win as an independent in Vermont because he has such high name recognition.
Right.
And Vermont's, you know, a small state and a special circumstance. But, you know, if it were somebody else, that would be difficult. So
okay.
He's made the exception that you know, prove the rule. But I don't think too many other independents can, you know, win races for the United States Senate or Congress.
Okay. It is 12:22 here in WASR. We're talking with State Senator Wolfboro resident Jeb Bradley. When does the new session start, and what are some of your priorities?
So we'll be back in session in January.
Oh, not till January?
Not till January, no. There are committees that meet, you know, during the fall. So I have a, you know, scheduled meeting on some of the bills that we retained for study on my health committee in a couple of weeks. So that happens. The bill filing period, you know, for new legislation has opened. So probably the biggest thing for me is to try to finish and get past changes to New Hampshire's bail reform law. That was one of the few bills that it passed the Senate fairly easily and, in fact, got bipartisan support, but it stalled in the House. And there have just been too many examples in New Hampshire of people that were charged with violent crimes because of the new law that passed a few years ago being let out of jail right away without having to go through a bail process, without having to go before a judge to determine if they were a potential threat and that they should have to post bail. And they got out, and they reoffended in a violent manner right away. And so I think the whole purpose, and I've worked with, you know, the police chiefs on this bill, the whole purpose of it is to make sure that not that bail gets denied to people. That's not the point. If they're eligible for bail, they ought to be able to get bail. But there also needs to be a process so it's not automatic and they're not just let out without any kind of bail on personal recognizance without going before a judge.
Okay. Now, I know it's happened. There have been instances, but when you look at the number of or the percentage of people that are on bail that reoffend, I wouldn't think it's that large. But or is this one of those things that even one is too many?
Well, I think it depends on the nature of the reoffense too. And again, I'm not trying to end bail. What right. I'm trying to end is this, you know, it's like almost an automatic turnstile. Somebody gets arrested, they get processed, and then they get released right away. And in too many circumstances in New Hampshire, they were arrested for a violent crime, released, and then almost immediately recommitted another violent crime. And so, you know, that's the violent part of it. And then the other part of it is if you know you're entitled to bail almost without any consequences for lower-level misdemeanor-type crimes, people aren't even showing up for, you know, their court appearances. And so, you know, that's not right either. And, I mean, there was, you know, this is kind of typical of, you know, the problem that we're trying to solve. There was just a video, as I recall, I can't remember where it was, but it was on, you know, the national news of, you know, people just walking out of a Lowe's, I think it was a Lowe's store, with thousands of dollars of electric supplies, and they know that the security people at the store aren't going to do anything about it. And even if they did, they're going to get, you know, processed and, you know, they don't have to post bail and, you know, nobody comes after them in the future. So this is the kind of thing that I think, you know, we're seeing rising crime rates around the country. And a lot of it has been this, you know, justice reform effort, which I think has backfired and has allowed too many violent criminals back on the street with no consequences, and they reoffend.
What I find interesting is, and you see them in other states, you don't see them here, bail bondsmen I mean, they must be here.
So,
or is there,
something in the questions as to whether it's the failure with the new the new bail reform law was judges, was you know, the people that actually do the bail, like you said, bail bondsmen. I don't know what it is, but you know, there's a lot of finger pointing going on. The bottom line is too many people have reoffended too quickly, and the reality is all I'm trying to do is make sure that in, you know, situations like manslaughter, domestic violence, kidnapping, murder, some of the, you know, really violent level charges filed against people, that before they're just set free on the street with no bail, that at least they have to go before a judge to determine whether they're a threat to, you know, society or potentially even themselves.
Okay.
So it's actually a pretty mild reform, but, you know, it's typical of what's going on in this country now, that people are far less concerned about victims and, you know, criminals have more rights, you know, according to sort of this progressive ideology. And I don't think it should be the case. I think we should be protecting victims and providing, you know, to the extent that we can, for safe streets and safe homes and safe schools. And you can't just have a turnstile of people being arrested and then automatically, you know, getting back out on the street again. Our problem in New Hampshire is not as bad as other states, but anybody that's, you know, watched the news over the last few years, I mean, New York was a classic example of, you know, people committing over 100 crimes. They get processed, they get released, they're back committing crimes again. It's almost like there's nothing they can do about it. I say, no, we need to halt that kind of thing and make sure that it doesn't happen in New Hampshire.
Will that bill get, you said it's stalled in the Senate. Is there any
No. It's stalled in the House.
Stalled in the House. Pardon me. Thank you. Is there any hope in reviving that?
I think it has a shot at coming back successfully, I hope. And I'm prepared to reintroduce it in the Senate if need be.
What happened to it in the House? It did get the votes it needed?
They couldn't get it out of committee, so they held it over for study. And, you know, there was a lot going on. I mean, look, there are a lot of groups that, you know, as part of this progressive ideology led by the American Civil Liberties Union, that basically thinks, you know, there are too many people in jail and that there are too many crimes and that we shouldn't be charging people, you know, with crimes. And I think you're seeing what happens around the country when you defund the police, when you undermine the police, when you undermine, you know, the criminal justice system and the bail system, you have soaring crime rates. Hasn't been as bad in New Hampshire as other states. I'm not trying to suggest that, you know, we're some of these other states that have made more news, but this is how you go down that road. And, you know, I'm a firm believer in making sure that we have good protection for law-abiding citizens. That starts with police, and it starts with, you know, sanctions against people that commit crimes.
Okay. 12:31 here in WASR. Thank you very much for listening today. It is Friday. Some clouds outside. However, no rain in the forecast. Are there any bills in particular you're keeping your eye on?
Well, I think, you know, until we get into January, you know, it's a whole new slate. There are some bills that have been held over for study. I think there's going to be a big debate about vaccine policy, although I felt that, you know, we passed a bill last year, was House Bill 220, that protected people from government-ordered vaccines in New Hampshire. Some people think it went too far. Other people thought it didn't go far enough, which told me it was probably in the right place. But I'm sure that you know, we're going to be debating vaccine policy, given what, you know, President Biden has ordered, and how that's going to be, how that's going to play out. I mean, obviously, Governor Sununu is joining with other, you know, governors fighting back on it, because traditionally that's a states' rights issue. And I think, you know, they made no exceptions, really. And, you know, I don't think people should be losing their jobs, especially, you know, in healthcare settings when we have a shortage of healthcare workers. If they're not vaccinated, they're going to have to do, you know, wear masks and protective gear and things like that to be safe. That's certainly the case. And so far, hospitals, even though they, you know, want to have their staff vaccinated, and I understand that. Look, I'm vaccinated, have no problem, you know, saying that. But when you start mandating it and you don't take into account people's individual health, okay, I talked to my own doctor about this the other day, you know, and I was asking him, and he happens to be practicing in Massachusetts, and, you know, I asked him, what do you think about these mandatory vaccines, and do you think it's a good idea? And he said, you know, that he thinks vaccines, certainly thought I should be vaccinated, and I was and am, but he said, you got to look at, you know, everybody's risk category. You got to look at their underlying health conditions. You know, so there are certain things like women of childbearing age, there's, you know, more question marks, or young men that, even though it's rare, the myocarditis symptoms, or, you know, what about people that have had COVID and have natural immunities, at least for some period of time? I don't know that we know, you know, exactly how long, but, you know, studies in Israel have suggested, I think, pretty strongly that you actually have better immunities toward COVID and all the variants if you've already had COVID than you get by taking the vaccine. So why are we mandating and firing people that have already had COVID and have natural immunities? So I think there are a lot of questions that have been unresolved about this mandate, and I'm glad that the governor's pushing back on it.
As you well know, the federal government is paying for all the vaccines. Assuming a third dose is cleared, and that should happen, from what I'm hearing, within the next week, week and a half or so, if it happens.
Well, it could even happen today. I think it's with Pfizer. They're debating the you know, the booster application, and we'll see what happens. I mean, you know, there were two FDA scientists that resigned because they thought that, you know, the whole discussion about boosters was being rushed, and it was more political than scientific based. And so, you know, we'll see what the FDA says today on the Pfizer booster. But if boosters are fully authorized and, you know, researched appropriately, I think the same as, you know, nobody had to pay for a COVID vaccine, and I think that should be the case for the boosters. I think if vaccines are the right thing to do, and I think they are, and I think they are definitely, you know, helping people get back to, you know, normal life in this country, I think that if boosters are proven to be effective and safe, then the federal government should pay for it. But this idea of, like, you know, mandating that somebody will get fired if they don't get vaccinated, I think we'd be far better off talking about the efficacy of vaccines, the science of vaccines, how they work. And quite frankly, Eric, saying, please get vaccinated and thank you for getting vaccinated. And maybe the Biden administration you know, would offer some congratulations to the Trump administration for developing the vaccines in such, you know, an expeditious way to tone down the politics of vaccines, because I think that also is a huge problem with, you know, people that are vaccinated pointing the finger at people that are unvaccinated. That shouldn't happen, because everybody's health is an individual, as my doctor told me the other day, it's an individual matter that needs to be assessed by the individual with his or her medical advisors. And I think the more people that get vaccinated, the better. There's no question about that. But some people's risk profile demands caution.
That's fair.
Yeah, it is fair. And that's why this mandate is wrong.
Well, what about mask mandates? Like if you go into, I don't know, 7-Eleven, and they have the right to make you wear a mask.
I don't have a problem with that, because you're stepping onto somebody's private property. And what, you know, is funny, now driving, you know, back across the country and going through, you know, in the last month, I think 17 different states, you know, every state's a little bit different. You know, as I've gotten back to New England, more people again are wearing masks. I don't think, you know, people that don't want to wear masks and they're vaccinated, that was the whole reason to try to get people to be vaccinated, so they wouldn't have to wear masks, so they're not at risk. But I think if, you know, I got home and got a virus in my computer, so I had to go into Staples, you know, several times over the last few days to try to get it fixed. Thankfully, they did.
Oh, good for them. Yeah, it's not easy either.
Yeah, they asked that people wear masks going into the store. I think it's their right to do so. And, you know, I think, you know, I'm not suggesting Governor Sununu should reinstitute a mask mandate. I don't think it's necessary. But if, you know, individuals want to wear masks or individual businesses feel better asking their patrons to wear masks, I understand that.
Okay. What about the Biden administration's vaccination mandate for federal workers and contractors? Does that fall under that same thing?
That's no different than what I was just saying before.
Okay.
Everybody's health is an individual based on their circumstances. So, you know, I had a long conversation with my doctor about this the other day. He knows, you know, what I do, you know, my day job. And so, you know, I'm picking his brain. And again, you know, he says he talks to every one of his patients about their individual circumstances. And in most instances, he's going to recommend that they get vaccinated. But, you know, again, young men, myocarditis, women of childbearing age, there are some red flags there. Or people that have at least, you know, temporarily got better natural immunities by virtue of the fact that they've had COVID. I have talked to people that have had COVID, then took the vaccine, then got real sick. So there are issues with that too. So the question is, does a one-size-fits-all approach, you know, mandated from, you know, President Biden work? And I don't think it does. And I don't know that, you know, most legal scholars, I think, feel that those are more states' issues as opposed to federal issues. Now, yes, for the military and federal workers, I suspect he has the authority to mandate it. Whether it's the right thing to do or not, based on, you know, everybody's health care is, it's your own individual, the conditions that you have. I think most people, you know, would do well with a vaccine, but not everybody. And that's where I think mandating it becomes a bit draconian.
All right, 12:41 here on WASR. It's Eric Scott as we talk with Jeb Bradley, who lives, in, of course, in Wolfboro and is our Senate Majority Leader. Long as we're on the subject of doctors and choice, what, if anything, do you feel about the Texas heartbeat abortion law? Should it be blocked in light of Roe v. Wade? Because that's currently in the court system now.
Yeah, and I who knows what happens when it gets to the court. What they decided and not, issuing a temporary restraining order is that they hadn't based the case on the merits. So that is going to, happen in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. There's another case that the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing on Mississippi's law.
Mississippi, yes.
Look, I'm pro-choice. I think that the Texas law goes way too far. I don't support late-term abortions. That's something to me that's very different after, generally after 24 weeks, which is seen to be, the threshold of when a baby is viable outside the womb. And that's where Roe v. Wade, has sort of drawn the line. So I don't support, late-term abortion, but I am pro-choice. And so, if a Texas law gets introduced in New Hampshire, I won't be voting for it.
Is it time that Roe was challenged to bring it up? It is a 50-year-old case. Or is that the point of these bills, is to get that challenge up into the nine wise souls in Washington?
Well, I think when individual states pass laws, they're passing it based on, what the people in those states think. Then, folks that don't like that law can challenge it, at the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll see what happens. Obviously, the inclination, I think, of the Supreme Court right now is on the pro-life side of things. But whether, with a 50-year Roe v. Wade law on the books, or the court has adjudicated it in that, fashion, that it's, a right, so to speak, because of the court decision of Roe v. Wade, whether there are five justices to overturn the precedent of that, I think remains an open question. And as with everything else, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Something tells me it will be resolved relatively quickly, maybe within the next year or so. It depends on whether the Supreme Court takes up the case or not.
Well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. All right, switching gears now. A couple of days ago, Brody and I discussed a representative from Belmont who proposed seceding from the United States. We both felt it was counterproductive. I'm curious if you know anything about this and your thoughts on it.
I only know what I've read in the press. I don't think it'll go anywhere, and I don't even think it'll get to us in the Senate. If it does, I'm certainly not voting for it.
Makes sense. Okay. Is there anything the general court could or should do to reduce the number of job openings? We've got all of these jobs that are going begging. Is there anything that the state can do to get people to work more? Obviously, the pandemic aid ended, and that didn't work.
And, I think that as the heightened federal benefits for unemployment expire, you're going to see people having to go back to work. It's a process. It's one thing in the middle of a pandemic to try to be safe. But now that, 65% of New Hampshire is vaccinated and we have one of the, higher vaccination rates in the country, and I think, with the rise of the Delta variant, more people are starting to get that haven't been vaccinated again. I think these long-term generous unemployment benefits that pay people not to work, should expire, and I think, hopefully that'll convince people that they should go back to work.
Well, it's been 3 months, and I haven't seen a whole lot of improvement. Any ideas as to why that may be?
I don't.
Okay, that's fair. 1247 here on WASR. Thank you very much for listening today. Let's turn to emergency management. As you know, tropical storm or hurricanes Henri and Ida have done some pretty good damage down in the Gulf Coast, Louisiana, and parts of Alabama, Mississippi, and Texas. Do you think New Hampshire's ready for a storm like that?
You know, we've been fairly fortunate in New Hampshire on, you know, a whole range of issues. We don't generally have to deal with wildfires or earthquakes or volcanoes. And our flooding has not been, even though we've had some instances of, you know, pretty severe flooding, it certainly hasn't been to the extent that other states have had. I'm not sure why that is, but we've had, you know, good responses when there have been floods. I mean, when I was in Congress, the it was the 2005 floods, you know, and again, and I think it was Hurricane Sandy, the aftermath of that. You know, we've certainly had our share of, you know, opportunities for floods, but just our topography is maybe a little bit different, a little bit better, and hasn't been quite as damaging, and that's a good thing.
Yes, it is. But is New Hampshire emergency management up to that kind of task? Because
I'm sorry, I should have answered that question too. Absolutely.
Oh, that's okay.
I think that you know, we do have really good professionals, both local and state. You know, whether it's fire departments, police departments, Homeland Security in New Hampshire. Yes, I think they're up to the task.
Okay. Let's talk about redistricting. How is that going, and how long will it take?
So the redistricting committee, and I'm not on it, is having a series of hearings around the state. I think they want to take, you know, the input of, you know, people around the state. Then plans get drawn, and, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, I really can't say much more about it than that at this point. I haven't been actively involved. Other members of the Senate are on the committee. But first, the hearings. You know, I will say this. You know, people have wanted a transparent process. They're going to have a transparent process. I think there'll be a hearing in every county. And, you know, it'll be a transparent process.
All right. When to bring employers to the state of New Hampshire, is it a good practice to provide tax incentives?
New Hampshire generally has not done that. I mean, in some rare instances, we have. I mean, Dean Kamen's initiative in the Manchester Mill Yard for Cell and Skin and, you know, even eventually, hopefully, organ regeneration was a notable exception to that. And the reason we don't offer a lot of tax incentives is we have a pretty attractive tax climate in New Hampshire. That gets back to the first question. No income tax, that's huge. No sales tax, that's very helpful. No capital gains tax. We have responsibly lowered our state's business taxes. And everybody, you know, when we first started trying to do this in 2015, people said the sky was going to fall, revenues were going to drop through the floor, we wouldn't be able to fund state government, yada, yada, yada. But what actually did happen is the economy grew faster than expected. It's continued to grow, you know, faster than expected. I don't think that lower business tax rates were the only issue there. I think we have a pretty good tax structure. We've made reforms to our workers' compensation system that, you know, were very helpful in lowering the cost of doing businesses. We've got a you know, motivated workforce in New Hampshire. So I think we have not ever really needed to have tax incentives to attract businesses to New Hampshire, and because we have a good tax climate. And I don't think we should be changing that.
Okay. With all the job openings, do you think that's going to be a drag on New Hampshire's economy?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that, you know, you're seeing this nationwide where there are millions of jobs going, you know, unfilled, and there are supply chain issues that, you know, some have gotten a little bit better, like lumber, you know, it's improved somewhat. But, you know, try buying a new car right now. We're not getting computer chips because, you know, they're made overseas and we don't have our own industry that does it here in the United States. And so hard to buy a new car because they are so driven by, you know, technology. So this is, you know, a big economic problem for not only New Hampshire, but our country.
So what's a possible answer?
I mean, well, stop paying people not to work.
Right.
And I think that, you know, our benefit structure has been, especially during the pandemic, which was justified for a period of time. But as we are, you know, hopefully seeing the end of it as, you know, even the Delta variant is starting slowly to wane a bit, you know, and hopefully as more people get vaccinated, we go from like the 60% range to the 75-80% range, you know, I think then there's really no excuse. But, you know, you got an administration in Washington that, you know, doesn't really believe in work, and they believe in benefits. And, you know, I think we saw it. When you pay people not to work, they don't work.
Okay. 12:54 here on WASR. Amazon now has four places here in New Hampshire, Nashua, Sandown, and Manchester, and their PillPack facility also in Manchester. And, of course, with size comes power. With power comes political power. Maybe not now. I mean, obviously, there are bigger companies here in New Hampshire than Amazon. However, it's really it's growing very, very quickly. Do you think businesses like that will be a political force, especially if they join together?
You know, I think that one of the bigger forces in New Hampshire, you know, goes in the business community, there too, really, is, you know, the Chambers of Commerce. People listen to them. And the Business and Industry Association, as well as the National Federation of Independent Businesses. So somebody like me, you know, is the reason I keep running and enjoy my job as a senator is I think that the most important thing that, you know, we can do is set the stage for people to have the opportunities in their life work-wise that they need. And I, you know, I always will listen to, you know, groups or representatives of business interests. And so, you know, I think glad Amazon is here in New Hampshire. I don't think any one institution, you know, should be all powerful, but certainly, you know, it's the same thing with your tax credit question. You know, we want to set the stage for a growing economy. A growing economy, gives opportunity to individuals, and it also, you know, think about what we've done, and I touched on this earlier, with a growing economy over the last few years. We've dedicated a lot of new resources to substance abuse, as well we should, to mental health, as well we should, to the problems of child abuse and neglect, environmental protection, water system upgrades. You know, a growing economy has made that possible. And so to me, that's, you know, the most important thing that any of us, you know, in Concord can do. And you know, I look forward to a successful 2022 in that regard.
While we're on that subject, as you alluded to earlier, as far as the price of things, lumber, even I've noticed cat food has jumped substantially in price when you can find it, which I find interesting, because then I have to go out and buy, you know, a case of cat food just to make sure I don't run out. But is the current inflation going to be a problem? And if it is there anything that the state level can do about it, or is this just an economic money supply problem?
I think this is a Joe Biden spending problem and a Joe Biden, frowning on domestic production of energy in this country. I mean, look, you know, a year ago, the price of gasoline was, what, about $2.15?
About that, yeah.
In the state of New Hampshire, it's now, you know, almost a dollar higher in most places. And I saw gas, you know, driving across the country, in some locations it was over $4 a gallon. So I think as long as we have these very expansive spending initiatives that look like they're going to go on as far as the eye can see and not rein in, you know, our deficits, inflation is going to be with us. And I think, you know, people are definitely seeing it at the gas pump. They're definitely seeing it, you know, at the supermarket. And again, I think you're going to see even more of it as businesses, you know, in order to get the labor that they need, are going to have to, you know, raise wages. I mean, that's happening as we speak. And you virtually can't hire anybody in New Hampshire for less than $13 to $15 an hour, and even that's pretty low.
Yeah, it is. In our last couple of minutes, I came across House Bill 445. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but it has to do with competitive bidding in Carroll County. Do we not have that now?
You know what? That is a question I can't answer. It's probably something to do with the House members and the county delegation. I'm not on the county delegation. That would be a question for Brody.
Okay, I'll make sure I ask him on the next All Things Politics here on WASR. But, Senator, unfortunately, we are out of time. But, again, thank you for your conversation. We did miss you while you were on vacation, but I'm glad you had a good time, and we will talk to you next week.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, take care, Senator.
Thank you.
All right, 1 o'clock. News is next on WASR.